In the wake of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report, many pointed to the possibility that President Trump could be charged with a crime after leaving office. Mueller himself appeared to allude to that, stating in his report that the president does not have immunity after he leaves office. But how would the charging and prosecution of a former president work? And are there any historical examples of that happening? Jens David Olien is an expert in criminal law and professor and vice dean of the Cornell Law School. Jens, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as we heard in the Mueller report, by the Department of Justice guidelines, a sitting president can't be charged with crimes. They have to be dealt with by Congress or not at all, I guess. Does a former president enjoy any special protections like that?
He or she doesn't. So Trump or any other president could be prosecuted once they leave office. That would happen by an indictment by the Justice Department that would have to be pursued by the next administration, the next attorney general, the next, U.S. attorney or, you know, whichever division of the Justice Department decided to pursue a criminal case against against Trump. There's all sorts of, you know, issues and obstacles relating to that. But I think the major sort of pragmatic question would be whether or not the next administration was interested in looking backwards and pursuing criminal accountability for Trump, or whether or not they decided that they should just let the past fade into the distance and try and, you know, bring healing to the country by sort of forgetting this whole unfortunate incident.
Have we seen cases in the past where a president, once out of office, was seen as likely to be subject to criminal charges? I guess Richard Nixon was pardoned by Gerald Ford, if you want to talk about that or other comparable examples.
Right. Nixon certainly anticipated that he might get prosecuted or indicted and was worried enough about it. So Ford pardoned him, and that's why Nixon was never prosecuted. Tough to know whether or not Nixon would have been prosecuted, but there certainly was substantial evidence that was developed during the Watergate investigation. So that's why he was never prosecuted. And in fact, the whole point of the Ford pardon is a recognition of the fact that a president can be indicted, because if a former president couldn't be indicted and prosecuted, then there would be no reason for Ford to have pardoned Nixon. The other good example, which is not a precedent, is Spiro Agnew. He was vice president, and he was forced to resign. And although he wasn't sent to prison or anything like that, his resignation came about as a plea bargain in resolution of a criminal case. That one is a slightly different, because no one contends that a vice president is completely immune from prosecution. You know, and the other example, which I think is interesting to put on the table, is, again, not one of presidential immunity, but it was Obama's decision not to pursue criminal cases against members of the Bush administration who were involved in the torture of Al-Qaeda and other, you know, detainees during the war on terror. And there was a substantial push to, you know, investigate and bring prosecutions against members of the Bush administration. And Obama made this decision that he thought that was a bad idea, that we needed to look forward, and ultimately decided that there wasn't going to be any criminal prosecutions.
We're talking to Jens David Olien from Cornell Law School about possible prosecutions of presidents after they leave office. Focusing on President Trump, what kind of charges could he hypothetically be vulnerable to on the federal level after leaving office, from what we know now?
I think the two most obvious ones would be obstruction of justice related to the information that Mueller outlined in his report. As you recall, there was, you know, one half of the report was basically about obstruction of justice. And Mueller laid out 10 specific examples or factual events that constituted or may have constituted obstruction of justice. So in terms of the Russia investigation, I think that would be the most likely source of a criminal indictment against Trump. And then the other possibility would be non-Russia investigation related criminal offenses that are either developed, you know, now by the Justice Department, by, you know, divisions outside of Mueller's investigation, or by other Justice Department divisions after Trump leaves office. I mean, it's possible that the information that Michael Cohen provided to prosecutors, information about financial dealings, potential fraud related to loan applications, et cetera, any number of those could possibly, or at least in theory, yield an indictment in the future against Trump.
Now, who would be the decider under a future administration after a president leaves office? Would this be something that would have to be decided by the attorney general, or could an individual federal prosecutor decide to pursue something? Where would something like that be decided?
All of the above. So an individual prosecutor would be in charge of developing the case. So either a U.S. attorney in a particular district, like the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, or federal prosecutor in charge of a particular division. For example, they have a specific division that deals with corruption for politicians, and the federal prosecutor in charge of that could start the case, but then it would have to be approved by not just the attorney general, but various deputy attorney generals in between those two individuals. And in theory, it may even have to go to the sitting president. So that's the thing, that ultimately there's no way around the fact that it would be partly a political decision in the sense that the attorney general himself or herself would have to authorize this prosecution. And in doing so, I think they would be looking at a lot of different factors. So on the one hand, they would be asking a very lawyerly question, which is, well, how much evidence is there? Is there enough evidence to suggest that Donald Trump committed a crime and that a trial is warranted? But then they would also be asking some more vague questions, like, is this a useful pursuit for the Department of Justice? Is it helpful for the cause of justice? Is it important for the country that we do this? And I think that's where things get very complicated and messy, because there's arguments on both sides. One argument is that really there needs to be accountability for past wrongdoing, but then there's also difficult questions about how we heal and move forward and try and sort of reclaim a sense of national unity.
When you mentioned hypothetical charges that could be filed, you mentioned obstruction of justice, which is something that happened while President Trump was president. You also mentioned some things that happened during the campaign before he was president. Do those two categories look different in the eyes of the law? Actions taken by a sitting president, actions taken by someone before they became president?
To a certain degree, yes, and to a certain degree, no. So they're the same in the sense that there's no immunity for actions that are performed while in office. So Trump doesn't have any kind of presidential immunity. It's not as if by being president, he's immune from prosecution after he leaves office, in the sense that everything he does is shielded from criminal accountability. That's certainly not the case. And so in that sense, whether he committed the crime during the campaign or committed the crime during office, the law doesn't care about that distinction. On the other hand, the one thing that does make things a little bit different is that actions that he engaged in during the presidency could potentially be defended as a matter of law with a constitutional argument that his behavior was part of his constitutional purview. Now, I certainly don't accept that argument. I think it's a very dangerous argument to start saying, well, the president can do X, Y, and Z because he's commander-in-chief and he's pursuing his duties under Article 2 of the Constitution. I think that's a very dangerous argument. But I think it would be naive to think that Trump wouldn't raise that argument. I'm sure that, because, for example, Giuliani and other lawyers who work for Trump have certainly said as much many times. So I think if he was prosecuted for obstruction of justice or other things he did while in office, they would be raising this argument that these actions are protected by his constitutional authority.
Jens, as we wrap up, I won't ask you to predict the future here, but from what you're saying, it seems like we've set a pretty high bar for what it would take to want to prosecute a former president, and we haven't jumped over that bar yet.
Yeah, it's tough to predict exactly what's going to happen, and I think, so part of this depends on what happens with the impeachment dilemma that the Democrats in Congress face right now. And technically, as a legal matter, the two aren't linked. So regardless of whether or not Trump is impeached or not, or whether or not he's simply voted out of the ballot box, voted out of office in the next election, either way, he could be subject to criminal prosecution. But the reason why I link the two is that impeachment in the House, even if he's not removed in the Senate, may quench a thirst for accountability that many people have. It might be precisely the kind of signal that people want, which is an official statement that there was wrongdoing here. And I wonder if there is an impeachment in the House, whether or not that will blunt some of the desire for a criminal prosecution, because people will feel like, hey, we've had accountability, we've had that labeling associated with his conduct.
Jens, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
That was Jens David Olien, an expert in criminal law and professor and vice dean of the Cornell Law School. He's with us today to break down what charging a president after he or she leaves office might look like and how this has been resolved in the past. The police standoff in Oconomowoc that began on Tuesday lasted 12 hours, shut down part of I-94, and at one point turned into a hostage situation before two suspects fled a stolen minivan and were apprehended. Both were hospitalized but are in stable condition. That incident was streamed live on Facebook by one of the suspects as she was being held at gunpoint by the other person in the vehicle. Many other situations involving police or ongoing crimes have been streamed live on social media. Some cases, those events have included violence and death. To raise questions about where and how social media companies should draw the line on letting users broadcast potentially violent or hateful content. Steve Knoll is a marketing professor and social media expert at Madison College. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Well, we see a lot of different live streaming alternatives from Facebook that everybody knows, Twitch for people to broadcast games, among other things. What's the goal? What are social media companies hoping to get out of making this possible for their users?
Well, the whole idea with live streaming is to build engagement. People love to see live. You think about like football games on TV, watching concerts on TV. There's something about real time that gets people excited, gets them engaged. And that's what social media is about, is building engagement. So they started, experimenting with live streaming. Twitter actually started with an app called Periscope. And the problem was, is it was before we really had unlimited data plans, and it was a big data crunch, and Periscope never really surfaced. But now, of course, Facebook Live, that's the big platform right now. And the idea is to really see what's happening in real time to other people. But of course, as soon as someone starts using it for good, someone figures out how to use it for bad.
Right. We've seen, I think the worst case, probably the Christchurch mosque shooting in New Zealand earlier this year, streamed live on Facebook. On Twitch, a shooting at an e-sport event was broadcast live on Twitch. Did social media companies go into this thinking, hey, we got to monitor to make sure really bad stuff isn't being sent out on our airwaves, quote unquote?
Yeah. What do you call it? Yeah. So, that's the thing that every social media company is concerned of. The problem is live is live. You know, that when something goes out live, it's instant. It's happening live. And how do you know if it's good content or bad content? And certainly there are computers, there's artificial intelligence and algorithms, but even that is still limited in the amount of time. In the case of the Christchurch shootings, it was about 20 minutes before everything got shut down and pulled. And by then, that was just a horrific amount of violence that was seen. And so that is a problem with these companies, is how to moderate live. Even live television isn't really live. If you watch like an award show, it's about 10 seconds delayed because they realize people swear. And now when you watch it, there's about a 10-second delay. But that's a single broadcast. When you think about a Facebook live stream, you're talking about potentially millions of people starting their own broadcast at the same second. And how can a company monitor every last one of them?
How are they trying? You mentioned artificial intelligence.
A lot of it is using AI.
And there are rooms full of people, right, that are trying to monitor content
on
Facebook.
Correct. It starts with the AI. It's they've got the computers that are looking for content within the data stream that can be flagged. And the AI is kind of the first step to flag it. And then if there's something that's questionable, it gets escalated to a human. But again, by the time it gets through that chain, you're talking seconds, if not minutes, before that person can, you know, get the stream, take a look at it, and analyze as to what is the context of what is being streamed. A lot of it is context. If we just started a live stream right from something, it would probably take you 30 seconds to really figure out what is the reasoning, who is this, and you don't want to jump to conclusions, because then you're getting into censorship issues. You're getting into the idea of, you know, who are the censors, and a lot of the live stream, you know, on the negative, you know, people who have been arrested, especially people of color, have turned to live streaming as a way to document, you know, bad things happening to them. And obviously, if they just turn on a stream and you see something going on, how long does it take before you figure out, oh, this is somebody just acting out a play?
We're talking to Steve Knoll from Madison College, marketing professor and social media expert there, looking at live streaming, bad stuff that goes out on it, crimes, violent killing sprees even, and how social media companies try to figure out how to monitor that and what should and shouldn't be going on over their live streams. Steve, on your way into the studio, you mentioned there's some new news here from Apple, a new app that is very relevant to the story. Can you talk about that?
It's an app. It's a shortcut.
Shortcut.
So, yeah, it's a shortcut. And it's actually called Police. And what it is you would download it, install it on your phone using Siri. And say, for example, you are being pulled over by the police. You can just say, Siri, I'm being arrested. And it'll trigger Siri to do two things. Number one, we'll shoot out a text to a predetermined person with a message saying, you know, I am being pulled over. And then it'll also start the recording on it. So it'll start the front-facing camera and start doing a live recording, and then it'll archive that into Dropbox. So even if something happens to your phone, if your phone's destroyed, the actual recording will still be in the cloud. And this is something they've just rolled out in the last few days.
Now, I know there's lots of laws in the state about recording,
yep.
And it's different from state to state.
Yes, it is.
Who has to consent to that? I don't know if a police officer as a public official can deny consent. I don't know. It's going to raise a lot of interesting legal issues.
It is.
Because you could use it not with a police person present,
yeah,
too.
And that's the problem with technology, is a lot of times these situations have to go to a court case, and then that will establish precedent as to whether or not this type of recording or video can be admissible or not. So that's the problem with technology. It's always a Wild West frontier. You try all this stuff, and some stuff will eventually be determined as being illegal. Some stuff will be legal. Some stuff will stay in that gray area. That's just the nature of new technology.
Now, you can see a government, maybe with good intentions, maybe not wanting to have the ability to stop something like, say, the live streaming of a Christchurch shooting kind of event.
Sure.
You could see them using exactly that same ability for a lot of bad reasons, too.
Exactly. You know, if people are doing a illegal protest, you know, what could stop a government from, you know, shutting down, you know, turning off Facebook or Twitter? We've seen this in other countries when there have been uprising, and the first thing they do is they turn off Twitter. You know, Twitter is, you know, so much about what's happening in the actual moment. And we've seen that in country after country when there's been a big political movement. The first thing the opposing government does is shuts down social media access.
Is this a case where social media put out this feature, in this case, live streaming, and didn't really think ahead on what people were actually going to do with it?
Well, yes and no. This kind of goes back to this whole theory that I have, that a lot of people, especially with Facebook, is they go into a lot of this stuff thinking that people are genuinely good people. And I think most are. But, you know, again, they put this out there thinking that people will use it for good, and then they just wait and cross their fingers that nothing bad will happen. Well, of course, something eventually will happen that's bad. I mean, you look at live streaming, you know, things of like, you know, a birthday party, and, you know, other members of the family can see it live, you know, all over the world. This is a wonderful thing that didn't exist 10 years ago. It's really, really neat. They're live streaming weddings and funerals and things that are very emotional that you want to have that real-time connection with, and you just don't have because of geography. So there's so many wonderful things about live streaming, but of course, there's a dark side to it, and certainly somebody will always find a way to use it for a bad reason.
That reminds me, there's more new news on this. I just saw a little while ago YouTube now trying to crack down on the ability under 12s, kids under 12, to live stream.
That's a good example of how do you determine that, because say that a 10-year-old turns on the YouTube Live app and starts live streaming. How long will it take before somebody at YouTube determines, oh, this kid is on their own and they need to have a parent, we need to cut the stream? how long is that going to be? Are we talking seconds? Are we talking minutes? Are we talking hours? That's a very good question to see how this rolls out.
In our last minute or so, Steve, what are some of the frontiers you're watching for of the issues we'll be dealing with live streaming?
Part of it is are we going to move to a point where it's going to be live with delay, like what they do with television, that you'll start a live stream, but it won't actually post to social media for, say, 30 seconds. And that 30 seconds will allow at least a computer to scan it and see if there's an objectionable content. At that point, is it really live video anymore? That's a big question, is live live?
Right. And if you're on Twitch, you want people commenting on what you're doing right now,
in real time,
not 30 seconds ago.
Yes, because then they can be reacting to what is happening in the moment. I mean, nobody's going to watch a football game knowing that, you know, somebody's going to find out if that they got that touchdown 30 seconds ago, because the other person, you know, listening to it on the radio already found out what's happening.
We'll leave it there for now. Steve, thanks as always for joining us.
Great. Thank you.
That's Steve Knoll, marketing professor and social media expert at Madison College. He's with us to talk about users live streaming crimes or other dangerous situations or events on different online platforms and how companies are responding. You can let us know what you think about all this. Should users be able to live stream content on social media? They can, of course. What sort of policies do you want to see in place at the companies, the YouTubes and the Facebooks and the Twitches of the world, to make sure bad stuff isn't out there? Let us know.